This is Monocle on Design, our weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's episode, we visit the London Design Biennale and speak to this year's artistic director, Ez Devlin. Plus, we meet the minds behind the pavilions of Ghana, Chile, as well as the pavilion of the African diaspora. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. The London Design Biennale 2021 has kicked off at Somerset House in the British capital, and the theme set by this year's artistic director is resonance. The theme asks us to consider the rippling potential and consequences of design, and countries, territories, states, and cities from six continents have responded with exhibitions. We start today's episode looking at the Global Goals Pavilion. Set in the courtyard of Somerset House, the installation is titled Forest for Change, and it serves as a centerpiece for the Biennale, taking visitors on a journey to learn about the United Nations Global Goals for Sustainable Development. This show's producer, Maile Evans, caught up with the Biennale's artistic director, Ez Devlin, amongst the foliage to find out a little more.
So we are standing in a forest and we're surrounded by birch trees, weeping birch trees, hazel trees, hornbeam trees. And you can hear the sound of birds around us. And what's surprising is that this forest is actually in the middle of a city. It's in the middle of London and it's at the heart of the courtyard at Somerset House. And it's the centerpiece of this year's London Design Biennale. And it all began 2 years ago when I was invited to take on the role of artistic direction of the London Design Biennale. And as a formality, Jonathan Riki, the head of Somerset House, gave me a tour. He showed me all of the spaces and he said, this courtyard space, you can do anything you want in it. The only thing you can't do is put any trees in it. It's written into the covenant architecturally. The Enlightenment principles on which the building was designed specify that this courtyard must never house any trees. So of course, instinctively, just as a response, I said, well, we'll build a forest. And then of course, over the past 2 years, trees and wildlife and nature have become more present as we've turned our attention to them, as we've gone on our daily walks, as we've observed them go through the seasons, from observing the shapes of their systems to observing the buds, the flowers, the leaves.
What hast thou done? Thou hast mistaken quite and laid the love due sorts of true love sight. About the wood go swifter than the wind, and Helena of Athens look thou find.
In literature, forests are often used as places of transformation. The characters go in as one thing. They go through a process of questioning and challenging themselves when they're in the dark of the forest, and they emerge enlightened. That's kind of the point. And in this case, there's a clearing in the forest, and when you reach it, you'll come across 17 brightly coloured pillars. And each one stands for one of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, which were signed up to by every single country in the UN. And really the idea is that they take on massive challenges, huge global problems, but they do it in this brightly coloured, simple graphics way that makes it a little less overwhelming, a little bit more approachable. And my hope is that having come through this forest, having heard these birds, having paid attention to all these species of tree, you then find yourself a little more open. If you can accept that there's a forest in the middle of Somerset House, hopefully you're a little bit more open to accepting that there may be ways to approach these 17 challenges and to find solutions.
I want people to be kinder to one another.
I want to see a world where all women and girls have the resources and freedom to reach their full potential.
You're able to add your own voice to this circle of voices. You're able to add which of the goals you feel most resonates with you. So your voice, once it's added, will resonate around this series of pillars. And then from there, you enter into the rest of the London Design Biennale. There are 38 countries. And actually, they're not all countries. We really wanted to move away from this sense of nationalism around a biennale. So there is a pavilion of the African diaspora, which Innie Archibong has put together. There is a pavilion of the Antarctic. There's a pavilion of designers in the middle from Palestine and Lebanon. And we've really tried to become more collective and more inclusive in our definitions of what statements we want to make as designers.
We collaborated with Philip Jaffer, the landscape architect, to bring this forest to life. What was the process like, you know, working with the material that isn't inert, it's living?
Well, having had this idea and having a kind of vision and doing a computer-generated image of what a forest might look like, you know, the things I'm used to working with are pixels and Photoshop. But obviously, I didn't have a clue of how to execute this. So I actually spoke to a good colleague who's a gardener, Declan Buckley, and he introduced me to Angus Cunningham from Scotscape, landscape designer. And he then introduced me to Philip Jaffer, who's the forest architect, who is an extraordinary designer of gardens and landscapes. Between them, Angus and Phil were able to closely monitor the trees at Bartram Nurseries and figure out which trees would be in the right level of leaf and at the right level of maturity and which would thrive in a really difficult condition for them. They're in pots. And it's clearly not a forest that's been planted. It's a fake forest. It's a rehearsal for a forest. It's a piece of theatre. And just like any piece of theatre, it tells a story and then it moves on. And in this particular case, these trees all have homes lined up in Islington and in Southwark, in urban reforestation projects. And then the shrubs are all going to a children's hospice. Greenfingers is a company that Scotscape works with a lot to find good homes for shrubs after they've been used in this way. So it's a hospice for very sick children who'll be enjoying these shrubs.
And going back to the wider biennale, the designers taking part this year have had to face huge challenges to bring their works to life. What has it been like seeing those projects come to fruition and how entrants have adapted to the parameters that have been thrown up this year?
The good thing about designers is we're used to working to parameters. That's what we do. We're told this is the size of courtyard, this is the size of the budget, this is the time that we have to load in. And we know that we have to work to those parameters. So I have great faith that if you give designers a few extra parameters, they will work to them. And I think as designers, I guess we've slightly been waiting for these earth parameters to be somehow imposed on us from on high. We've slightly been waiting for carbon parameters, carbon budgets to be imposed on all our projects. It hasn't happened. And I think what we're realizing is we need to self-impose these parameters so that the future won't look back on us as practitioners and say, what the hell were you doing? What were you doing making a design biennale about waste of resources, but you were using so many resources to talk about not wasting resources, right? The implicit contradiction in that for designers doesn't go unnoticed, right? So I think that's the conclusion we're all reaching. And I've seen it everywhere across the pandemic. I work in a range of genres, whether it be music or theatre or art gallery and museum work. Everywhere, people are having the same conversation. How do we approach some of these global goals in our day-to-day?
Ez Devlin there. She's the artistic director of the London Design Biennale in 2021 and was speaking to our Maylee Evans. We turn our attention now to Chile, whose pavilion this year takes a historical look at the theme of resonance. Focusing on ancestral stone-built technologies, the interactive installation uses musical instruments consisting of rocks, or lithophones, to trace Latin American design back to its roots. We spoke to co-curator Carola Ureta Marin to find out more. That was Carola Ureta Marin there. She is co-curator of the Chile Pavilion. Now we are heading over to the Ghana Pavilion, titled Amplify. It aims to explore the engagement between Ghana, Great Britain and Denmark over four centuries. Nick Manise caught up with the pavilion's co-curators, the designer Chrissa Amua and architect Alice Asafwa Adje. Chrissa began by explaining how their collaboration on the exhibition started.
Alice and I have known each other for over a decade now, and the opportunity came for us to represent Ghana at this year's Biennale. So we've collaborated, bringing together our respective skill sets and design expertise. And we have created an installation that starts actually here with the history of Somerset House, where the Biennale is taking place. When we looked into the history of Somerset House, we saw that in the 17th century, Queen Anne of Denmark created a saloon here where she would invite artisans from across Europe, and they each played a role in its architecture, the architecture that we see here today. And you could even say that they played a significant role in the foundations of Somerset House's creative legacy, which we are all benefiting from now.
When we were invited, we had a walk through Somerset House, and as Chris has said, you know, we're actually really inspired by the architecture of Somerset House. But one thing that was quite telling was the fact that there had been influences from European artisans, and maybe as far as Fielders, well, not as far as Fielders, Africa, where at the time the Danes as well as the Brits had a colonial influence on Gold Coast. So Ghana was called Gold Coast at the time. So Amplify is really addressing aspects of that, looking at how things could have been had artisans in Africa been invited to actually influence the development of Somerset House. And we're relating it to current times to see how things have evolved and how there's an equitable exchange of ideas and trade between Ghana and the West.
So what, I guess, is the lesson moving forward, perhaps for young Ghanaian designers? What do you hope that they, I guess, see this, they hear that story? What do you hope that they take away from it?
We've used brass in our installation, and it's a material that is very significant to Ghana and its cultural and social history. It still plays a role, but it is actually a dying craft. So we're also looking to shine a spotlight on that fact and to encourage people to patronise it and to patronise the artisans, some of whom we worked with for this project. We want the young Ghanaian designers to see the value in their cultural history and their cultural narrative, and how they too can influence design and the problems that design seeks to resolve on a global platform.
Is there anything you want to add to that, Alice, in terms of takeaways?
And I think it's not just young Ghanaian designers. I think it's a global thing, you know, that we all learn from our histories and be influenced by our history and really just look, have positive ideas and ways of engaging with other people from other parts of the world. Because the way we're going now, all our lives are intertwined. So the Ghanaian designer would influence a designer in London, and a London designer would influence a Ghanaian designer. So certainly a move forward for more collaboration and understanding of each of our cultures.
Obviously, we're an audio medium here, but are you both able to sort of run me through what we're looking at on the wall here?
So we have a wall of 69 brass discs. They vary in sizes from 20 centimetres to 90 centimetres. We have five different designs, actually six different designs, and we've looked at texture. Texture plays a significant role in this installation, but also the commodities that Ghana currently exports that holds great global value for Ghana. So things like pineapple, things like palm nut, raffia, timber, and so on. And those commodities have inspired the textures that we've created on these circular discs. And the wall is backlit. So there's a contrast of textures. There's a moody ambiance. And there's also nice, beautiful, shiny discs.
Shiny. Everyone likes shiny discs.
Yeah. I mean, that's what drew me in, I'm going to be honest, is the shiny disc.
That was Chrissa Amua and Alice Asafwa Adje, co-curators of the Ghana Pavilion. They were speaking to Monocle's Nick Manise. Next in our coverage of the Biennale, we head to a contribution designed by Alta Projects in partnership with award-winning Paris-based studio Sever & Co. The multi-sensory installation makes use of smell and sound to elicit memories from visitors. Let's meet the curator, Anne-Laure Pengrian, to find out more.
The installation basically is an audio olfactory installation, and it's meant to bring forward any forgotten memories and also to just help you tune in with yourself and kind of soothe the senses and so on, and kind of create that little niche space for you to to reconnect with yourself and see what resonates with you at that point. Smell is a huge thing, you know, smell and actually sound as well, but smell particularly just connects with emotion. So through smell, you can actually, there's a really wide opportunity for us, you know, to create reaction from visitors and triggers emotions and so on. So that's why smell was so important for us. And where it's coming from, people won't be able to see, but it's actually a little cartridge, and the team at Sever is extremely amazing in terms of engineering and creating something new, because with smell it can be really empowering and kind of overwhelming, but they managed to create something similar to a candle. So, you know, a candle is there, doesn't smell, you switch it on and it does smell, and you switch it off, it doesn't. It's the same thing with here. So with the metronome, when it's on, you've got a cartridge with little beads that are infused actually with the scent. When it goes back and forth and kind of catches the wind, then you will smell something, and then when we switch it off, it will stop. We didn't want to have something very specific where people would be like, yeah, this is like grass, or this is, you know, a flowery, blah, blah, blah. You know, we didn't want that. We wanted something where you might pick up that some ginger notes, somebody else might pick up something else, or it might actually remind you of you know, your grandmother's sweater, you know, and that's the whole point. It's to open this up and to be more of an allegory than anything else. And the sound is top-notch and absolutely incredible, which you can hear here. And Moodsonic have done, I think, some work in the past with KRA. They have created this really long, 30-minute-long soundscape for everybody to kind of discover different things at different times, and using the ASMR as well to trigger different type of emotions. But basically all of them working together between Steve to create the entire experience, plus KRA with their incredible product, and then Moodsonic with their vision in terms of the soundscape makes it work. Being a curator, I'm always quite critical when I go to see an installation, and I'm like, oh God, it's such a shame they didn't think about the soundscape or you know, like the smell. And I always wonder what that might be. So I think it's pushing people just being more adventurous, and designers being more adventurous in that sense.
My thanks to Anne-Laure Pengrian there. She was speaking to Nick Manise. Finally, on today's show, we head out to the River Terrace of Somerset House, where, at the London Design Biennale, visitors will find the Pavilion of the African Diaspora. The installation, named The Sail, is the first in a series of three architectural follies by the American-Nigerian designer Ini Archibong. Here, Ini shares his inspiration and lets us know why the pavilion serves as an act of monumentalism and a site for gathering. Ini began by introducing The Sail and what visitors will encounter on the riverfront.
Sitting on top of stone bases, we have concentric arches designed from catenary curves of different degrees and magnitude, vibrating concentrically from the base upward to a height of about 8 meters. And between the arches, we have sail fabric holding it all together. And it's an artistic representation of, of a metaphor, with the aluminum arches representing the resonating, vibrant voices of the people of the African diaspora, overtaking a sail and pushing us into our future. All of this started with my approach to the topic of resonance, which is the theme for the Biennale. And, you know, in order to address that, I do what I sometimes do with my art pieces. I create a narrative, and this narrative was a mythological story that is particular to the African diaspora, being that there is no, I guess, unified lineage of the African diaspora to have a mythology to come out of. There is the freedom to create one from scratch. So in this mythology, there's a magical shell that represents, you know, the ability to make a rallying call to the rest of the diaspora to bring together council to engage in discussing the topics relevant to the diaspora in that moment. The impetus for whatever mythological story that I'm going to create, it starts first with what the goal or the intention of the project is, right? So once it's established that this is about Black voices, this is about the diaspora, this is should be something that tells a story that makes it feel like there's a through line from the past and the ancient all the way through into the future, the actual storytelling is just imagination and creativity. There's symbology and there's different things that people automatically associate certain ideas with that get to be brought into play that serve as inspirations. There's also the fact that, you know, I've spent my entire life reading comic books, reading mythology, being obsessed with superheroes, watching movies, manga, you know, all of this stuff. It makes it so that it's not that difficult to come up with an imaginative, you know, story about heroic, you know, adventure. I think projects like this and the project that I did for the Dallas Museum of Art, both those projects deal with this mythology and deal with these stories that are important in order to put the project into context and for people to understand, I guess, the spiritual significance of what I'm trying to purvey. The sail, you know, is representative of the mode of travel during the time that most of the dispersion happened, whether it was Africans that were sailing themselves to foreign lands or it's the transatlantic slave trade. Those both represent the dispersion of African people to the rest of the world. Being in London, being in Somerset House, and the history that we have in this place, in this location, in this country, it makes it that the sail was the relevant piece to bring here because it speaks toward the past that the United Kingdom has and their contribution to the dispersion of Africans through the transatlantic slave trade, as well as the fact that it's the home of so many of the members of the diaspora that should be carrying this thing into the future. This is the first of three, the sale. The next one, the Wave, is coming in New York. All three of them will be together in Miami in December. New York, the Wave Gate, is, you know, it's a freestanding sculpture again that is made up of, I guess you could say, concentric resonating arches meant to represent the resonating sounds of the voices of the people of the diaspora. And as such, New York, for me, holds a special place in my story and in the history of the people of the diaspora as far as spreading the black voices to all corners of the globe through the art form of hip-hop. You know, for me, it's a foundational part of my creativity, and I can see exactly how the spreading of our black voices took on a new dimension after the birth of hip hop. So we celebrate that in New York. And then Miami, we're bringing all three of these things together on the shores, on the water. And yeah, I hope that we can take that opportunity to celebrate the Afro-Latin Caribbean people of the diaspora and what they've brought to a place like Miami and to the world. I've never executed anything of this scale. I'm learning as I go. You know, I studied architecture. I studied like all the things that allowed me to have the tools to conceive of and to design these things, but I've never built architectural follies of this scale. You know, this is the first time that I've stood underneath one of my creations, right? The largest things that I'd been making before were, you know, chairs, tables, things of that nature. The thing that drew me to the concept of the folly is that, you know, this is an exercise in monumentalism. This is about placemaking through monuments. So the folly being not necessarily the piece of architecture, but the gathering place and the structure underneath which certain events and things can happen made it, you know, the appropriate approach to take. I think that when you talk about the African diaspora, it's important to recognize that the African diaspora doesn't have that many monuments in the places where the African diaspora occupies that represent us. You know, whether it's in London or Paris or throughout the US, the most we might have might be a monument to a person whose ideas the establishment has deemed okay enough to erect a monument for. But very few things we have out there that are abstract in nature that represent a concept or idea that can move into the future in a way that it stands for something that is just about us and stands in a place where we would feel comfortable to then occupy that we might not feel so comfortable to occupy otherwise. So in that sense, the folly was the most logical thing for me to create, as opposed to a tent. It didn't make sense for me to take a nationalistic approach to this brief. I also think that it says something about the diaspora. I think that there are commonalities between people that are from the largest continent on the planet that are so spread out. One of those commonalities is inclusiveness rather than separation. I think that most would tell you that, you know, people of African descent are inviting, you know, that I think that the inclusionary aspect of what it means to be part of the diaspora makes it make sense that we've done this. And it's not a slight or a knock on anything that is nation-based, because there have been many contributions, you know, that are based on groups that come together under a flag. So you know, it doesn't diminish that at all, and it's not a negation of the value of that. I do hope to have more opportunities to work at this scale. I think that monuments are an important thing, and I think that monuments are, I don't want to say a political thing, but I think that monuments make a statement about place and about where people belong, what people have contributed. To me, those aren't political things, but they can and have been politicized. But I think that it'll be important that those of us that have the skill set to create monuments that can have meaning for our people are doing that. So I do hope that I'll be doing more at this scale in the near future.
My thanks to Ini Archibong there. And that's all the time we have on today's show. The London Design Biennale runs until the 27th of June at Somerset House in the British capital. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, then catch our 5-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced and edited by Maley Evans, with editing assistance from Sean Heckey and Chris Ablakwa. Thanks to our researchers, Nick Manise and Charlie Phil McCourt. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.